So, what we again, we had the list of the Yisraelim, we had the list of the Kohanim, we had the list of the Levim. Along the way, we have now suggested four different explanations for why we have the name list. Right, we had the view that this was the style of poetry that that they used. This was considered to be fine poetry to have such a list. We had the second view, Rabbi Angel's view, that it emphasizes the importance of human beings as opposed to the structures that they're going to build. We had a third view, also presented by Rabbi Angel, that it makes the list look longer by noting everybody who's there by name. It makes it look like you have many people who come, or the opposite, it looks short. It looks like you have a small group coming back because you're able to list them in this series of verses. And then we have the idea that I expressed last time, which is that these are the founders of a new land. These are the people who establish all of the institutions going forward. I pointed to the list of the Kohanim who serve in the temple and how they're taken from this list. I talked about how the Talmud has a list of those who brought wood as karbanot, as their gifts, regularly to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, and how the list largely, with one exception, comes from those who ascended with Zerubbabel. So that these are the people who are founding all the institutions. They are, to a certain extent, the nobility that's setting up the new land, and they're the Mayflower families, to use an American analogy. I don't know was there a boat for Canada? Is there a boat that you can provide a similar analogy with? They were not Vikings, no. It was something with a French name, probably. They came to Quebec. So, however you're going to do that, you understand what I'm saying, and that was the fourth idea. Well, this week, we are going to have to propose a fifth idea for why this list is here. And the reason why we are going to need a fifth idea is because all four of those explanations, with the possible exception of the first, that this is just the way they did poetry, but certainly the other three explanations all fall apart when you get to what we're up to now, which is chapter 2, sentence 43. The best term I can provide to explain the rest of this list is to hark back to a term that was probably ill-advised when it was initially used, and that's the deplorables. That's what you're going to find in the rest of our list. Meaning, what we are going to have here are the people who have problematic lineage. The people who can't prove that they are Kohanim. They say they're Kohanim, but they can't prove that they're Kohanim. People who do not have Jewish lineage for one reason or another. People who are part of a servant class, and servant is a euphemism, as we will see. These are people who are not going to be part of Mayflower families. It won't work. Saying that that's why this list is here, that doesn't explain it. And saying that this list is here because you're celebrating the people, it just doesn't apply to what you're going to break down here. If you're really celebrating the people, you wouldn't pick out a group of them and say, yeah, these are the people who couldn't prove that they actually had proper lineage. That's not the way that you would list them. There's something uncomfortable about what we're going to see. Last time we had the list that was very comfortable and very happy. Not what we're going to see now. What we're going to see is a very difficult list. And so I want to actually talk about this concept before we see it inside. When we think about the challenges that the Jews face when they return for the second Beis HaMikdash, for the second temple, one of the major problems that they do face is the question of how we identify Jews after we've been in exile. Because things happen. Even in a short, relatively short exile of 70 years, that's a couple of generations. And remember, they were told, set down roots, pray for the welfare of the land. You are now Babylonians until I bring you home. And even though we've talked about how they had a hope of coming back, and they retained knowledge of the city they came from, and they retained knowledge of their tribe, nonetheless, especially when you consider the fact that their last years in the land of Israel before they were exiled were not exactly good ones, right? It's a period of idolatry. It's a period of corruption in the leadership. It's a period when they're being told repeatedly by Jeremiah, by Isaiah, God has abandoned you. Things weren't so hot at that point before they went to Babylon. Now they go to Babylon, and people do mingle into the land. One of the major themes of this book is going to be mixed marriages. Jews who actually married into Babylonians or others. So this is a problem that they face coming back to Israel, is who is a Jew? That's a fundamental challenge that they have to confront. So that's on one level. What we're about to see is them trying to confront this. But Sharon asked me a question when I came in today, and really I am very grateful for this question because it points to a whole other angle that really this has to be looked at with. Did you have a similar issue with when the Jews came out of Egypt? We did, right? What was the situation when we came out of Egypt?
A whole lot of Egyptians followed him.
Sorry, the Arab Rav, correct. If you, well, not even the Safsuf. The Safsuf, whether that's the same group is a good question. But long before that, we have the Arab Rav.
But that wasn't in Tamar.
Correct. No, those are people who just join in. But that's true. It's not an issue of problematic lineage. That's correct. But it's an analogy to what you see here in terms of people who are joining the Jews, but who are going to be looked at as different and, in fact, problematic. If you take a look, go back to Shmot, to Exodus, chapter 12, sentence 38. It's page 165 in the Stone Tanakh. And by the way, there of course is one case that we know of where there is, you know, a child born of a mixed union. Whether they're married or not isn't it? But you know the business with the Shlomit Bat Divri and the child who grows up to be the Mikhalel, the one who curses. And the allegation is, well, it says a Ben Ish Mitzri. He is the son of an Egyptian male, and a Jewish mother. So you do have that case as well to work with, although it stands out as an exception by the fact that you have one. The fact that they're able to signal and say, this one, suggests that it was only this one. But take a look at Shmot Yud Bet Lamechet, 1238. The description of the Jews who come out of Egypt, it says there were 600,000, right? 600,000 males, and that's as we count separately the males of military age. V'gam Erev Rav Allah Itam. And then you have Erev Rav, as they translate it here, the usual translation, the mixed multitude. You're familiar with the Medrash about this mixed multitude and how they end up getting out of Egypt with us? No? Oh. The way the Medrash tells it is that they get out of Egypt to come with us because Moshe says, I want them with us. And God says, this is a bad idea. Right? You have I learned that in grade school. They taught us that. And boy, did that get ingrained. This was a bad idea, Moshe. You made a mistake. And God comes back to call him on it in Shmot Perek Lamed Bet, Exodus chapter 32. Talk about xenophobia. Exodus chapter 32. Moshe is on Har Sinai, and he gets the word from God that there is a problem down below. Right? This is always the best argument against those who argue. I mean, the Medrash argues that Moshe was supposed to be up on the mountain for 40 days, and then the Jewish people miscounted. And that's a classic pshat drash split. And there's reason for the Medrash saying that there was a delay. And that Moshe, and that was like that they miscounted. There's reason to say it. However, if you look at Shmot, Exodus chapter 32, sentence 7, it's on page 217. Hashem says to Moshe, go down the mountain because, you know, they made this calf. He doesn't say to Moshe, go down the mountain because 40 days are up. Right? He says to Moshe, go down the mountain because they made the egel. It sounds like Moshe was not due to come down from the mountain. But that's a tangent I shouldn't have started on. Let's stick to the point. Chapter 32 in Shemot, in Exodus, sentence 7. What does God say to Moshe? Lech raid. right? Go, descend from the mountain. Ki shicheis amcha asher ha'aleisa me'eretz Mitzrayim. Because your nation, who you took out of Egypt, has become corrupt. What do you mean, your nation? Right? It's like parents, right? Your kid. They look what your kid did. Says the Medrash, this is talking about the Erev Rav. This is talking about the group that Moshe insisted on taking out of Egypt, and they are the ones who trigger the golden calf. Now, that's part of a bigger discussion about who created the calf. Why did they create the calf? What were they trying to accomplish? And I don't mean to go too far afield with this point. My point, though, is you have this idea when we leave Mitzrayim, when you leave Egypt, of people who are hangers-on and who cause problems. They're not quite like everybody else. Yeah?
Who's blaming the others for the God or like who's saying this?
Well, God says your nation. It's the Medrash that explains your nation means the Erev Rav.
It's because of the people, the hangers-on.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, because he said...
So there's no such thing as conversion until you get to Sinai. At Sinai, whoever's still there will have converted. And I guess it's true. This Egel is post Sinai. So yes, at this point they're Jewish. Yeah, you're correct. They would then be Jewish. But they're the people who Moshe insisted.
Yeah, but right, I think it's suggested.
It's only 6 weeks after.
They had converted before they left. The verse 12:38. A group of people of various nationalities converted to Judaism and accompanied the Jews out of Israel.
Okay.
That implies they converted before they left.
Okay. Even better.
They basically did the conversion.
Even well, they weren't in Israel yet. The chief rabbi didn't have a say yet. They hadn't even seen the file. But you're right. Rashi is making it even stronger that they're Jewish. This is better for my case. That they're analogous to the group of people we're about to see here.
But now I have another question.
Okay.
Because when we go to chapter 32.
Yeah.
And Hashem says, your people, which are the Erev Rav, and why is he calling them a stiff-necked people, implying all the Jews are stiff-necked?
Right.
Because if the Erev Rav did it, why are... Right. You're
right.
All being condemned.
Right. So, you know, if we were doing this on the Egel, if we were devoting the class to the golden calf, we could talk it through in depth. But basically, you find a range of views in the commentators about who exactly is at fault, both in terms of being the catalyst and in terms of those who followed and participated and so on. The Gemara talks about some people dying with one punishment, some people dying with another punishment because they had different roles in the act. My point is to say, though, that we talk about analogies between coming back under Ezra and the original emergence from Egypt, like we talked about with their neighbors giving them wealth to take with them back to land. This is another analogy. Even though, as was pointed out before, the people we're going to be talking about here, a lot of them are Jewish. Some of them aren't. But a lot of them are Jewish. So it's not a perfect analogy, but if they in fact converted at the get-go, then we actually have a much stronger analogy to it. The point is, not everything is simple when you come back to the land, any more than it's simple in our own day. Right? And of course, if you project to the time of Mashiach, the Gemara talks about Eliyahu coming along, not to declare people out and to say this one's lineage is out, but to include people who had been under doubt until then. So there's an idea of this being relevant in the time of Mashiach as well. Elisheva and then Gita. Yeah. So it's not so much that it's wrong that it's according to rank, but that was taking the view, the way that I presented that explanation, was that we're showing sort of the founders of the new land. The people we're about to read about, or the people we're going to read about here, are not called founders. They're called, you know, people who can't prove that they're really Kohanim, and therefore they're told you can't eat from the offerings, or descendants of Solomon's servants. These aren't people you list as founders. Gita.
Yeah, if in fact Erev Rav is the one he's talking about, why would God get so upset about them having an egel?
What do you mean? What do you mean?
That would be part of their background. Why would he focus on them?
Right. To which the end, well, no, he didn't focus on them if they're the ones who made it. In other words, these are the people who I told you don't take out of Egypt. You insisted on bringing them along, and look what they've done.
Exactly, that they brought them. Okay.
Yeah.
No surprise.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So what I'm going to suggest is actually, yeah. Sorry.
I just want to say it sounds to me like it's still what we said last week—a book of pedigrees, except it's giving the bad stuff along with the good.
Right. But the question is, why would you give the bad if it's in?
Because you have to discern who it. Because they're coming into a problem, into a land with problems, with Jews with problems.
Right.
And you're bringing yours, and you can't have people think, oh, the ones that came from Baba from. They're okay. They're not.
Right.
They're not okay, and they're so it's the safer Yichus thing, except the problematical ones as well as the
But that's exactly it. I think, in other words, to me,
but that information is important. Right.
To me, that's reason E for this list. In other words, to me, that's the fifth reason for having this list. And not that these reasons are exclusive. I think there are multiple benefits to having a list. But to me, and we'll see, this is actually the Gemara. It's not my invention. I just didn't realize what the Gemara was doing until I looked at it in this light. But the purpose of this list is so that you can keep track of who can marry whom. Who is whom within this population. And so we're going to list them by name, we're going to list them by number, and we're going to talk about where they lived. And that way, you meet somebody and you want to marry them. Well, where are they on our list? I think that's what this list is doing here. Shana had her in first. Sorry.
Just by analogy to the business of including the negative, I mean, isn't that the pattern throughout the Bible? That the Torah, if you were looking for the ideal sources for our patriarchs and our matriarchs for the history of the Jewish people, right, would any right-thinking group start by establishing themselves as subservient and slaves and then having to overcome that?
Right, that's true, but it's inconsistent with the reason of we're presenting the founders, so we have to come up with another reason to record it, and this is it. I think that's the answer. Ralph?
Why would all these people want to come anyway? They're better off where they are.
So that's a really good question. Why did they... Right.
To adapt to
right.
themselves to a tough situation, reestablishing a nation. I don't see what...
So that's a really good question. If you are a descendant of Solomon's servants, why in the world do you leave Persia? What is there for you in this land? That's Ralph's question. David, and then Dahlia, and then Ari.
It is just a question.
Oh.
When do we assume Ezra wrote this book, in terms of the history that he's telling?
We don't know. In other words, we know that it's not in chapter 2, because Ezra's not even there yet.
Because it's very different if he's looking back.
Well, he's unquestionably looking back.
Or if he's writing it as his answer.
Right. Unquestionably, it's written after the moment. In other words, the list is written in the moment. We talked about this earlier, how Dat Mikra points out that there are hints within the list itself that it's written when it's happening. For example, the fact that the animals they list are pack animals, not farm animals. Things that tell you this is an authentic list being written when it happens. And Ezra is then putting it into the book when Ezra actually writes whatever else you have for in this book, but all the filler between the lists. But he's doing that. He's compiling after the fact. That's true. Dahlia, you want to say?
I was just going to say that it's very logical to me if you look at the formation of the New World, the United States, and Canada. And who came here first, or who came to Australia? And a lot of them were, like prisoners and
middle
class people, indentured servants, people who wanted to start a new life, people who didn't have lands back home, and who thought that by starting out in this new place, they may get lands. And if they think that God is with the Jewish people and we have a good reputation, a lot of these people are going to want to tag along, thinking that this is a new way to make a better life.
Right, and that approach that
the history of humanity.
Right, that approach that they're looking for a new life works better in Australia than it does in this case, because in this case, the place where they had a bad life wasn't Babylon. The place where they had a bad life is the place they're returning to. I mean, we're going to see right now, the first group that we're going to meet are the Nitzinim. The Nitzinim have a horrific experience among the Jews. Why in the world? Stay in Babylon. What are you coming back for? I'm not sold on the idea that they're finding a better life. I think this is a real difficulty. But let's take a look. Take a look on your sheets, please. It's source number one. Yeah, all right, sorry.
I can really understand. Why do people look into, other than people want to get married, why do people convert to Judaism today with all their anti-Semitism?
So you think that this is a spiritual thing?
Well, I know two cases of two separate people who worked in Israel as hell for 4 years, and then they had to come to Canada, and they're just waiting to get their Canadian passport so they can go back to Israel. And one of them said to me, she's from Nepal, she believes in reincarnation. She said, I should pray when I reincarnate that I will come as a Jew. So, you know, us Jews, why would anybody want to be a Jew? But
I have all sorts of reincarnation jokes in mind, but I'm not going to. But I think it's possible. Maybe it's a spiritual thing. I don't know. Yes, Louise.
Involuntarily.
Yes, they. I believe that they're joining voluntarily. Although honestly, I can't prove it to you. There are others who will be identified as coming as avadim, as servants. But they're not. They're not listed that way. So that's what makes me think that they're not coming into service. It's possible that it's a spiritual thing. It's so odd. And for anyone who is coming back at this stage thinking this is a new hope for them and they can now have a way to change, this list is a real bummer. Like, you thought you were going to start fresh. No, no, no. We're actually going to list you by name. you're one of the Nitzinim. Good luck. It didn't work. They didn't lose their identity. So let's take a look at the source number one. It's a very important Mishnah. From the fourth chapter in Kiddushin. It says, Asara Yuchsin Olu Mibavel. 10 different lineages emerged from Babylon. Meaning, those who came back to the land were identified as being part of 10 different groups. Kohani Leviyei Yisraeli, Kohanim Leviyim Israelites. And if you look below that in the English, you'll see what I did there. The Gemara, in its expansion of this Mishnah, shows how you know each of these lineages, where they're found in the text. So, Kohanim, Leviim, Israelites, that's the list that we saw last week, right, from the beginning of Ezra chapter 2. Halali. What is a halal? No. It is a corpse also, but not in this case. Right. It's from the term for desecration. It's a Kohen whose kahuna has been desecrated because there was an illegal marriage in the line, and this is a descendant of that illegal marriage. So the Kohen is disqualified from certain types of service.
Is that like Kohen Hashem?
Yes, same root. It's also the term for being mechalel something, when you redeem something that was holy, rendering it mundane. Same term is involved. Halal can mean space, to be a vacuum, and it's used for outer space today. Yeah. That's correct. There are a lot of things you can actually do with the word halal. It's worthy of its own description. The halal meat. Yes. So, halali are hinted at in chapter 2, sentences 61 to 63, which hopefully we'll get to. You'll see why. It talks about kohanim who are not allowed to participate in certain ways. Geirei, people who convert, v'charurei. Charurei means slaves who had been slaves, who had been non-Jews, who had become avadim, and then had been freed. So they also have the status of converts to Judaism, and they will not appear in this list, but in Ezra's list of those who come with him in chapter 6. I gave you the reference there, chapter 6, sentence 21. It will speak of those who left behind that which they had among the nations and came to join this religion of God. Then you have Mamzerei. Mamzerim, children born of certain illicit marriages. You don't find them here. You'll find them hinted at in Nehemiah chapter 7, which is the second version of this list. The Netinim. I'm not going to define Netinim yet. We're going to get to it in a moment, and at that point we'll have to see why Netinim is a mess. But Netinim is another category. And then Shtuki and Asufi, which are also from that Nehemiah list. Shtuki and Asufi is a term for people who have lineages that are unknown. As the Gemara talks about, Shtuki is when the child asks, where's daddy? And mommy says, shh. right. That's lishtok, to be silent. They and then asufi is a foundling, a child like asof, to gather, a child who was taken in from the marketplace. So those we'll have to leave until we get to Nehemiah chapter 7, the second iteration of this list, and you'll see how that's read into the verses. But the point is that the Mishnah says the group that comes out of Babylon is not all Kohen Levi Yisrael, everything is simple and clear cut, but you have all these people with lineages of different degrees of acceptability, meaning the convert, the freed slave, they're great. The mamzer, on the other hand, is going to have a problem. The netin is going to have a problem, as we'll see. So if you take a look at source number two, this is why I say that this is our fifth reason for having the name list, in addition to all the other reasons. Amar Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, why isn't Ezra showing up in the beginning of his own book? Why didn't he come out of the exile? Lo ala Ezra mi bavel an sha'asa'a kisoles nikiya ve'ala. Ezra, according to Rabbi Elazar, is working on identifying who's who. And he stays behind in Babylon to work on all of these different identities until he has made it like pure flour, meaning that everybody knows who's in and who's out, and then he ascends. Now, today we have a certain discomfort with the idea of identifying who's in and who's out. The idea that people are going to be drummed out is not so popular. But when you think of it in terms of its, you know, this is the legal system and who can marry whom, it becomes a necessary function, being able to say, this is someone who is Jewish, this is someone who is Jewish but can't marry so-and-so. That has to be identified, and that's a principal concern for the Jews who are on their way back. Okay, so let's actually see some verses. Laurie.
We're talking about the people who made this journey to Israel. What about the people who made it?
We'll talk about them too.
Because we don't have their heritage.
Oh, don't worry. I'm coming back to this. Okay. And it's going to come back also to a comment you made a few weeks ago that's also going to be relevant. So hang tight. We'll get there. It may not be now. Maybe January 3rd. But I have it in mind. Okay, so what's the story with Nitinim? Take a look, please, at Pasuk Mem Gimel. We're back in Ezra now, chapter 2, sentence 43. It is page 1817. We're only going to be there for a moment, so don't get too hung up on it. Then we have other things to see. But the sentence begins, Hanitinim. You see it?
Yeah.
The Nitinim, which I assume all your translations just say, the Nethinim, or something along those lines.
Temple servants.
Temple servants, it says. Ooh-ah.
Gatekeepers, I've got.
No, gatekeepers will be at a different verse. That was the Shoarim we had before. Yeah. This one, it should just say Nitinim, although temple servants is itself interesting. And then it's going to start listing some names, which we'll have to come back to. But what's the story with these Nitinim? Who are Nitinim? And what's also interesting, if you flip ahead a little bit to the end of the list of Nitinim, if you go to sentence 55, Pasuk Nun Hey, you will find that along with the Nitinim, we also have Avdei Shlomo, the servants of Solomon. Now, we don't mean superannuated servants of King Solomon, right? They've been here for 400 years. They went into exile for 70 years, and now they're heartily marching their way back to the land. What we mean is descendants of the servants of King Solomon. So who in the world are you talking about when you talk about Nitinim? Why are they lumped together with the servants of King Solomon? Take a look, please, at chapter 8, sentence 20 in the book of Ezra. Chapter 8, sentence 20 in the book of Ezra. It is on page 1831. This will give us our first clue. This is when Ezra is back in the land. And we identify here a group, Umin HaNissinim, right? The Nitinim. Sentence 20. Shenasan David v'hasarim la'avodas halevi'im, those whom David and the nobility gave for the service of the Levites. Nisinim masayim ve'esrim kulam nikavu v'shemos. 220, all of them identified by Nitinim. So now we know more about Nitinim. Did you notice in the Hebrew the origin of the word Natin? Natan. They were the ones who were given. They were given to the Levites for their service. Now, King David, according to this, has assigned them to work for the Levium, meaning you're dating all the way back to the Mishkan, before there even is a Beit HaMikdash, before there is a temple. They're working on behalf of the Mishkan, and the origin of the name Netinim would be that verb Natan. But why them? How did they come to be servants of the Beit HaMikdash? So we have a record that goes all the way back to Chumash, of people who were actually assigned to such a role. And here, take a look at your sheets, please, at source number 4, and I'll ask you to find that verse. So you want Bamidbar, Numbers, chapter 31, sentence 30. Little exercise isn't bad. It's page 409. This is after the Jews fight the war against Midian. Right? Remember the story after the business with Bilam, the daughters of Midian, the daughters of Moab. The Jews fight a war against Midian, and then they divide up the spoils. So take a look at sentence 30. Right? You see that? Umachatzis b'nei Yisrael, they divided up the spoils in half. Half the spoils go to the soldiers who went to war, and half goes to the rest of the Jewish people. So umachatzis b'nei Yisrael, from the half that goes to the Jews, tikach echad achuz min hachamishim, take 1/50, 2%, min ha'adam, min ha'bakar, min ha'chamorim, min ha'tzon, mikol ha'beima, from all of the spoils, from the people, from the different types of animals, everything. V'nasata osam la'leviim, and give them to the Levites, shomrei mishmeres mishkan Hashem. Those are the ones who guard the Mishkan. They are responsible for the tabernacle. That's the first time we find people who are dedicated for this role of serving the Mishkan. That's your first group, is from the war with Midian. But now let's fast forward. Yeah, David. Okay. Fast forward to Yoshua. Is there a question down there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I'm wondering, so why the team who are they?
Who are the Midianim?
No,
the Nitinim. So according to this, Nitinim are the Midianim who were assigned to work for the temple. Well, maybe. That's what it sounds like right now. Okay. However, jump forward to the time of Joshua. And what you want is in chapter 9, sentence 23. And again, I gave you the reference on the sheet. You can refer back to that if there's any confusion. Page 539 in the Stone Tanakh. And this is the story of the war with a nation called Gibeon. Okay, a little bit of background on this remarkable story. It's chapters 9 and 10 of Yehoshua. The Jews come into the land with instructions. Their instructions are, before you come in, you can make peace with the seven nations. Once you come into the land, either they leave, or you go to war with them until you've destroyed their society entirely. Right? We are told already back in Dvarim, back in Deuteronomy, that the reason the Jews are getting the land is not because they are wonderful, but rather because God is fed up with Canaan. He says, these people have built a society that is so horrific, so abusive, and so pagan, that they cannot be in my land, and I am bringing you in because I don't want them there anymore. They're horrible human beings, and they should be moved out. Now, yes, that leads to a whole other discussion about ethnic cleansing. Some other time we can have that discussion. I've done it in other classes, but it's not going to be right now. But that's the statement, is they don't belong in my land. You are not getting the land for, it's not, I'm not getting rid of them in order to help you. I'm giving you this land as your reward for doing the job of getting rid of Canaan. Oh, and by the way, you had really nice grandparents, and it's nice for their descendants to have this land too. That's essentially why we get the land, as recorded in Chumash Devarim. So, one group says, we're going to be clever. We know those Jews are uncompromising, and they're not willing to make any covenants because they've already crossed into the land. So what we are going to do is, we're going to pretend that we're from far away. And they show up to the Jews and they say, we are from far away, we have this ragged clothing, we have this spoiled bread, stale bread, because we've been traveling for a long time to get here. You know, you have nothing to fear from us. We would like to make a covenant with you. And Yeshua makes the covenant apparently without conferring with God. And that's its own story where this fits into the narrative of Yeshua in the course of his leadership. He makes the covenant with them, and then they find out that these mysterious Givonim are actually Chivi. They're part of the Chivi tribe, which is one of the Canaanite tribes. They live right next door. Right? A little research, you could have looked them up online, you know, you would have found out this is where they live. But that's and then they discover it's a trap. Nonetheless, they have already sworn not to harm them. So you could say, well, I swore, but it was under false pretenses. We didn't know any better. But Yeshua is very concerned about what that will do in terms of the reputation of the Jewish people. They will become known as people who make a treaty when it's convenient for them, and then break it when it's convenient for them. And so he says, we are not going to do anything to the Givonim. However, this is now where you see chapter 9, sentence 23. He said, after saying, why have you deceived us? Right, in sentence 22. Then it says, Ve'ata, and now, Arurim atem, you are cursed. V'lo yikares mikem eved v'chodvei eitzim v'shove mayim lebeis elokai. Never will you cease to be slaves, choppers of wood, drawers of water for the house of my God. You will become servants of the Mishkan. So apparently there weren't enough Midianites, or the Midianites had disappeared, because now we have a new addition to the class, and those are the Givonim, who are going to be quasi-Jews. They're going to work for the Mishkan. We're not told anything about a conversion. They don't seem to be marrying in. And in fact, as the Talmud understands it, they're not allowed to marry in among the Jews. They marry among themselves. This is the group that becomes known as Nitinim, because they are placed in that role of the and the official term Vayitneim shows up later in sentence 27. If you look at the bottom of the page, Vayitneim Yehoshua Bayom Ahu, Yehoshua made them on that day, placed them on that day, Chotvei Eitzim, choppers of wood, and so on. So that is the use of the term nitin at this stage. There's actually another piece to the story, which I don't want to go to in great depth, but you can't start reading about the Nitinim without knowing this additional story. So jump ahead, please, to Shmuel 2:21. If you look at source number 5 on your sheet, you see that I listed it there. And if you want to know why I wrote, read the story and you'll find out why. It's because this is one of those stories that you just don't know what to do anything with. It's page 779 in the Stone Tanakh. One day, God willing, I will teach Shmuel, and at that point I will have to come to some kind of an understanding of this story. But as of now, I just have to shrug. See it? Page 779? There is a 3-year famine. I'm just summarizing, but you can see it here. There's a 3-year famine, and message comes to David from Hashem, presumably via a Navi, via a prophet, that it's because of Shaul, because they killed the Givonim. Now, we have no story of Shaul killing Givonim. We have nothing, no record whatsoever of Shaul killing the Givonim. So the Gemara supplies a backstory and explains. The Givonim, remember, were made servants. Right? They were made into servants for the Mishkan. So where do they get their subsistence? How do they survive? Who's feeding them? The Mishkan, right? The people who work for the Mishkan have to provide for them. Shaul, in his pursuit of King David, wiped out the city of Kohanim, the city of Nov. Says the Gemara, the city of Nov was the support base for the Givonim. Shaul wipes out Nov, and the Givonim starve. They don't have a means of survival, and that's why he's condemned for killing the Givonim. That's the backstory that the Gemara provides for it. Actually, you see it at the bottom of the art scroll. I see in 21:1, they note it. Okay, so David summons the Givonim, And here you get this little parenthetical comment. Those are the people who were allowed to survive by Yoshua back in the day. And David says to the Givonim, what am I going to do? How do I make this up to you? And they say, we don't want any money. No, we actually, we would like to have seven of Shaul's gone. We want seven of Shaul's descendants to die. That's what will make us happy, is if seven of Shaul's descendants die. And as you read the story, David says, okay. Which is where you say, what? But David says, okay. But he doesn't give them Mephibosheth. Mephibosheth is the son of Yonatan, David's friend. So he doesn't give them Mephibosheth. Instead, he gives them other ones and turns them over to the Givonim. And you see the story there. Really a problematic story in the extreme. Why is this at all relevant? Because the Givonim are the Nitinim. Right? That's the group. So take a look at source number 6, the Gemara in Yevamos. I didn't translate it here because it would have taken us off of the page. But I will explain it outside of the text so that those who don't have the Hebrew for it will understand. The Gemara in Yevamos says in source number 6, Mephias Velopai Sinu, David tries to appease them and doesn't succeed. Meaning he tries to argue them out of it and say, I'll give you money, I'll give you this, I'll give... No, we're not at all interested in that. We want blood. So David says, there are three signs of a Jew, right? You've probably heard this before at some point. There are three signs of a Jew: Rachmanim, Baishanim, and Gomle Chasadim. We're supposed to be merciful, we're supposed to be modest, and we're supposed to be generous. Those are our three traits, and the part that I skipped with the three dots is where they draw that from various verses. And he says, anyone who has these three signs, that's somebody who can stick to this nation. Otherwise, not. And so David renews the decree that they're not allowed to marry in, because he says clearly these people aren't eligible to be Jews. If you're not merciful, you can't be a Jew. Right? That's part of the conversion process, apparently, as we have to find out, is the person merciful? And then it goes through the story of Ritzvah Basaya and how David chose which one and why David went ahead with this. And it claims that the reason why David went ahead with it is because of the lesson it would send to the world if Shaul, the royal family, the former royal family, loses seven members because of the way they mistreated the lowest of citizens. That will send a very important message to the world about justice. That's the justification in the Gemara for doing so, which is a nice message in favor of justice, not such a nice message in favor of, you know, punishing the people who are actually guilty. I'm not sure what to do with this, but that's the sorry?
Or the children of the former.
Yeah, that's basically what's happening. Those are your Nitinim. So if you want to know who these Nitinim are who we are listing, the Nitinim are a class of people who work on behalf of the Beit HaMikdash, Mishkan and then Beit HaMikdash. They appear not to be Jewish, not to be able to even marry in. Why they would want to come back to this land and do this again is beyond me. Unless the answer really is, they just are spiritual believers. They've bought into this. But I have to admit, I have a very hard time with that as a concept. But that's who we're talking about. Those are the Nitinim, and it's entirely possible that there were others who entered this class over time, meaning to become the Chot Ve'etzim, Shoav Mayim, choppers of wood, drawers of water, for the Mishkan.
Why did they get into exile? Just because it was a wide net?
Yeah, everybody went. It's not as though the Babylonians cared. I don't think they were even asking questions. Yeah. So let's go back to Ezra now and read the names of these Nitinim. So we are back to page 1817. Is everyone clear on the Nitinim at this point? Other than understanding that whole weird story with David and... Yes.
You said there's no basis for the sentence
of law. No basis for what? Sorry?
There was no basis for the sentence that they were destroyed.
I didn't... No.
We have no basis for... you gave so many sources just now. So I don't know why that wasn't a basis.
No, I don't know what you mean. No
okay,
basis
I
for...
I don't understand why you don't understand.
Okay.
I'll divide it.
Okay. I think I know what you mean. No, we have no record of a war against Givon, and you're noting that there's a parenthetical comment there that Shaul did it. The problem is that that story doesn't appear at all in Shaul's lifetime. In other words, we know what Shaul did. He did this, and then he did this, and then he did that. Well, maybe not, but that's what the Gemara is wrestling with, is I would think that if Shaul had waged a war for the purity of Israel against the Givonim who were working for the Mishkan, that would have been headline news.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the problem. So we are in chapter 2, sentence 43. Some of these names are references possibly, and this is what Da'am Mikra does, to what they did in the Mishkan. Other names here, though, no idea what they are. There's a Medrash that actually says some of these names that we're going to see are meant to be understood as negative nicknames. And Mikra tries to suggest ways in which you could explain the nicknames negatively. I'm not going to sit there reading into each name. We have too much to see to do that. But Hanetinim, Bnei Tzicha, which is an Egyptian name, according to Da'am Mikra, Bnei Chasufa, which could be a term for water drawer. To be chosef mayim is a term for drawing water. Chosef literally is to expose, right? Like in Baal Sur, chasov zra kochecha, to expose. So you would draw up the water from being in the well. Bnei Taba'ot, the people of the rings, and we know that the vessels you had in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, many of them had Taba'ot, many of them had rings. So maybe they man the rings, they create the rings. Bnei Keros, that's another one going back to the Mishkan, the krasim were hooks and loops that you had. Bnei Si'aha, no idea. Bnei Fadon, also no idea. Bnei Livana, children of the moon, maybe. Bnei Chagava, I don't know. Bnei Chagava, Bnei Akub, Bnei Chagav, so there's a Chagava and a Chagav. Bnei Samlai, which is an Arabic name. Bnei Hanan, Bnei Gidel. Gidel is a term for making wicks. When you take thread and you weave it together, tzitzit strings are called gidilim. So it could be they're involved with making or keeping the garments of the Kohanim. Bnei Gachar, Bnei Ra'aya, Bnei Ritzin. That's a classic Aramean name, right? Ritzin, like the king. Was it a king or a general? I think it was a king, Belach Ritzin. Bnei Nekoda, Bnei Gazam. To be gozeim is to chop wood. So this might be a wood chopper. Bnei Uzzah, Bnei Pasech, Bnei Veisai. Veisai is an Egyptian name. Bnei Asna, Bnei Meunim, Bnei Nifusim, Bnei Bakbuk, Bnei Chakufa, Bnei Charchur. Hey, don't laugh. They laugh at your name too. Bnei Batzluz, Bnei Mechida, Bnei Charsha, Bnei Varkos, Bnei Sisra. There's a name that rings a bell. The Canaanite name. Bnei Samach, Bnei Netziach, Bnei Chatifa, Bnei, and that's it for the, that's it for the Netinim. And it brings us to Shlomo's Avadim, Shlomo's servants. And that requires its own discussion. So if you take a look, please, on your sheet, I gave you a reference to Chronicles 2, Divrei Hayamim Bet, chapter 8. So you're playing with the end of Tanakh here. Chronicles 2, chapter 8. It's page 1957. Sentences 7 and 8. This is the time of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. Okay, people have it? So the verse says, all of the remaining Canaanites, Asher lo mi Yisrael hema, who were not Jewish, min bnei hem asher nosurach arayem va'aretz, from their descendants who remained after them in the land, the descendants of the Canaanites, Asher lo chilum bnei Yisrael, whom the Jewish people did not eliminate, vayaleim Shlomo lemas ad hayom hazeh. Shlomo made them his servants until this very day. Usually until this very day means the canonization of the book. There may be some exceptions to that rule, but that's the general case. So in other words, the remnants of the Canaanites are the servants of Shlomo, of King Solomon. This is not a group that works in the Mikdash, in the temple. This is not Netinim. These are the servants of the king. If you take a look on your sheet, I brought you from the Rambam, from Maimonides, source number 8 on your sheet. The Torah itself says, those who refuse to make peace with you, right? The those who don't accept, and those you defeat in war, they will be lamas va'avaducha. And that includes if they make peace once you've already come into the land. So what does lamas mean? So I would think of lamas as they pay tribute. What is va'avaducha? They serve you. So the Rambam tells you, don't kid yourself about these conditions. We like to think of ourselves as very benign people. V'ha'avdus she'kablu, this work they accept, hu she'yiyu nivzim u'shfeilim lamata v'lo yarimu rosh b'Yisrael ela yiyu kvushim tachas yadam. They are lowered. They will not raise their heads against Israel. They will be conquered beneath their hand. That have no illusions about this. The Rambam has no illusions, and the Rambam is generally among the more genteel who you will meet. The fact of the matter is that this is in line with the general sense that you find within Tanakh, that the Canaanim have become such terrible people, and you get models for them in the Torah. Over and over again, we're told about Sidon, we're told about Shechem. Those are meant to be education. Like, this is who you're going to meet, and these are the people that you're supposed to replace, and this is the role that they take on, that they are indeed going to be servants. Of course, if you're not Jewish, you won't call it education, you'll call it propaganda. They have no illusions about what we're talking about. This is what it is. Yeah.
They're not slaves, they're just indentured servants.
Yeah. I don't know why that makes me feel any better, because I don't like the word slave, because, you know, I grew up in North America. But let me make something clear, because I didn't and I should. This is not North American slavery. No, I want to make sure to make this clear. This is not North American slavery, meaning you have a biblical prohibition against doing anything to harm a slave. The fact is that as the Torah perceives it, these are people who you will have, who will not be free to leave, and who will do all the jobs that you don't want to do. That's the definition of an eved. That's what he's talking about here. You are not allowed to harm them, you are not allowed to starve them, you have to take care of them, and so forth. But it's not a nice thing to do. This isn't, I'm trying to sort of show you the boundaries on both sides. You can't be brutal to them, but on the other hand, no one's telling you to be nice either. So the
so can you say,
yeah,
that they are willingly coming back, or they are part of the property?
So the reason I say they're
property that right. You're bringing back.
The reason I say they're willingly coming back is because we're going to get to servants later on who sound like they're not willing. So it sounds like these are. That's my reason for saying that I think they are willing. But I want you to take a look at one more source, because that puts another spin on all of this and may explain why they come back. Take a look at source number 9. This is a very odd passage in the Gemara in Yevamos. This is talking about conversion with an ulterior motive. If a man converts to Judaism for the sake of a woman, or vice versa, or somebody converts because they want to participate in the table of kings, meaning things are good for the Jews at that time and they want to benefit, or l'shum avdei Shlomo, or to become a servant of Solomon. So Einam Geirim Diva Rabbi Nechemya. Rabbi Nechemya says that conversion is invalid. Now, I must note for you, it's important to know, that's not the Gemara's conclusion. The Gemara's conclusion is that so long as they sincerely accept the mitzvot, it doesn't matter why they did it, it's actually a valid conversion. The only question is, did they sincerely accept the mitzvot, which is what causes all, or not all, but some of the problems that we have today. But I'm not bringing it to you for the sake of Rabbi Nechemya's ruling. I'm bringing it to show you that the Gemara thinks somebody might convert to Judaism so that they could become a servant of Solomon. This apparently was viewed as something of some, you know, stature, that someone could have actually seen this as a good thing to become. So it's possible that at some point, this actually was considered a positive. This was considered something good, that you could actually become a servant of Solomon. Go figure.
What is a servant of Solomon after there's no more Solomon?
So a servant of the next king, and the next king, and the next king. It's just that Solomon is the one who in Divrei Hayom and makes them into servants, so they're called on his name. Much like retain the title Netinim, because of verses that refer to them as being given to this service, even when you're dealing with later generations.
They're descendants of, in this case, you're talking about...
But they're not necessarily. I'm saying anybody who served the Mishkan ends up being called Netinim. I don't think it's true that it's all biological descendants of the Givonim, and those are the only ones who are serving in the Mishkan. I'm not so sure that works.
But this reference here, is he talking about people who convert to become servants of the King of Israel in general, or Solomon specifically?
No, King of Israel in general. I don't think it's Solomon specifically. So, hang on. What I would like to do is make sure to finish the list of the Avdei Shlomo, and that way that'll be a good break point for us. So just to go through it. B'nei Avdei Shlomo, sentence 55. B'nei Sotai. How many of these names sound Jewish to you? B'nei HaSoferes, B'nei Pruda, B'nei Yala, B'nei Darkon. Sounds Greek. B'nei Gideel, B'nei Shefaja, B'nei Chatil, B'nei Pocheres HaTzvayim, B'nei Ami. Total, Kol HaNetinim. All Netinim, U'b'nei Avdei Shlomo, and Solomon's servants, Shlosh Me'od Tishim Ushnayim. Not a huge number. 392 of these
families.
We're going to have to come back to that question. That's a good question that we have to still reach. We have a number of questions that we still have to reach. One of them is the question of males versus families. It sounds like these are individuals, to answer your question.
Not very many.
Not very many at all. We also are going to see females listed in a bit. That's going to make it sound like this is actually males and females, not only the males. We're going to have to deal with the discrepancy in terms of the number of people who are counted here in the individual, and then the aggregate number of the 42,000, and that's going to bring me back to Laurie's point from this week as well as a few weeks ago, the question of number one, the question from this week of the people who joined in later on, as well as the question from a few weeks ago of what about people who came from cities other than Babylon? Because Babel is a city. It's not the empire. So what about those others? So we're going to actually have to address that as well. So I guess all of that is going to wait until January 3rd, when we'll pick up with Pasuk Nintet, with sentence 59. What we now understand, I hope, what we got out of today, is the issue of lineage, the fact that the namelists have yet another role, a much more functional role, of preserving the record of who is able to marry whom. We've learned about these Netinim, who are servants of the Mishkan, Avdei Shlomo, who are servants of the monarch, and we'll then see, we still have to go on to see, the people who had trouble with their lineage, who couldn't prove they were Jewish, or who couldn't prove that they were Kohanim, and then we'll get to our totals and more. So God willing, that will be after Hanukkah. Have a wonderful Hanukkah, and looking forward to resuming. Thank you.